ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله أما بعد Come as close as you can, inshallah, because my voice is not that loud. As you know, brothers, we're here to study the lives of some of the great Muslim heroes that have gone past, and inshallah learn lessons from them, because there's no point gaining this knowledge if it's not going to do anything for that. And the whole point basically is example, learn from the example. And inshallah we're going to begin with the story of Imam Abu Hanifa. And before I even begin, I will say to you straight that really, an hour you cannot do justice to this hero or any of the heroes really. You know, we're talking about their lives, we're talking about actions really. And, you know, so don't think that this is going to do them justice, but we just try to get just a few glimpses, you know, a few main points. And I would also say further that, you know, even this quote, even the material I have with me right now is too much for me to cover in the time I have. So if you have any questions later on, then please, you can ask me. Dave, inshallah, let's begin. I'll say by saying the first statement, and that is that this scholar, like other scholars, they reached their perseverance, their strength, their stances they made because of knowledge they gained. You know, the patience they had was because of knowledge they gained and their sincerity towards Allah. And that, inshallah, will be more and more become apparent as we go through it. And Abu Hanifa, rahimahullah, as you know, he was born 80 years after Hijri, which is 702, and he was a Tabi'een. Now, Tabi'een is somebody who met one of the Sahabi, one of the Sahaba. And of the Sahabi that he has definitely recorded that he's met, it's the unanimous amongst the scholars, is Anas bin Malik, who died 93 after Hijri. And he, Anas bin Malik, is called Khadimi Rasulillah, the servant of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because that's what he was. And he's also one of the people that obviously is quite prominent amongst the literature of hadith, because he gave out because since he lived a long time, many of the scholars of that, many of the people of knowledge, they took from him knowledge, and so it's said that he's narrated more than 2,000 hadith. And he lived about 99. He lived about 100 years. He had more than 100 children, Anas bin Malik. And he himself said that towards the end of this time, he said that there does not remain from those who prayed towards the two Qibla except me, i.e. who prayed towards Masjid al-Aqsa and then prayed towards Kaaba. i.e. pretty much he was the last person or one of the last people from the Sahaba to die. And one of the statements that he would say to his people a lot was, Ya Bunayya, Qayyidul Ilma Bil Kitab. Oh my children, something like this, that record knowledge, you know, with the book, i.e. record knowledge with writing it down. So right from the early ages, this is the kind of thing that he would say to people. And if you, inshallah, as we go through Abu Hanifa, this is what he did to his students as well. He would make them write the things down. No. And if you think about the students of Abu Hanifa, as inshallah, we'll try to touch briefly at the glimpses of touch upon them, you will see that they are very intelligent, smart people. So if they needed to write things down, then definitely we need to write things down. And the key is to not write down everything, but the key is to write down important points, just important points, and try to memorize those important points, those important lessons. Okay, that's the key to writing down notes, not to write down everything. And as you know, the Hanafi fiqh, which is the, you know, a fiqh is obviously the way we do individual acts of worship, is spread through more than half of the Muslim world today. But it's unfortunate that many of the people who say that, you know, we're Hanafi, they do not know his life story, because if they knew his life story, then they would know that clearly that the way he did things, the way he was dynamic, the way he had principles, you know, these people clearly don't have them. And inshallah, this will become apparent when you go through his life. So the Hanafi fiqh was predominant amongst all the other schools of thought in Islamic history. And inshallah, today we're going to cover why. And before we start going to his life itself, I thought it'd be important that we go through some of the great scholars have said about him. And this is especially important because about Abu Hanifa, there are many people who have hasad on him, are envious towards him. Okay? Even today, even later on, they people misunderstand him. So that's why, especially you go back to the people who actually met him, what they said. Sufyan al-Thawri, he said, Sufyan al-Thawri, he's one of the greatest scholars that ever lived, and you know, it seems to be clear that he was actually more knowledgeable than Imam Abu Hanifa. He was a contemporary to Imam Abu Hanifa in Kufa itself, which is a city in Iraq. He said to one of the students who's coming, who used to go and visit both Abu Hanifa and himself, Imam Sufyan al-Thawri, it's recorded that he once said to the students, "Where have you come from?" And he said to him, "I've just come from Abu Hanifa." Then Imam Sufyan al-Thawri, he said to him, "Laqad jitta min indi afqahi ahli al-ard." Verily you have come from the one who is the most knowledgeable in fiqh from the people of the earth. So for someone of his stance, from his stature to say something like this, shows that Abu Hanifa, you know, he knew stuff. He does not, some people claim that he was somebody who only knew fiqh and no hadith, because you can't know fiqh without knowing hadith, it's impossible. And Imam Abdullah bin Mubarak, inshallah, who will be covered today as well, who is one of the students of Imam Abu Hanifa, therefore you know he met him. He called him a sign from Allah. And also in another statement he said that Ra'aytu a'bada an-nas wa ra'aytu arwa' an-nas wa ra'aytu a'lam an-nas wa ra'aytu afqah an-nas, which means that verily I've seen the person who has worshipped Allah the most, and I've seen a person who has been the most Allah fearing the most, and I saw a person who was the most knowledgeable of the people, and I saw a person who was the most knowledgeable in fiqh from the people. He said, as for the one who worshipped Allah the most, for he is someone called Abdul Aziz bin Abi Dawood. And as for the person who is the one who is most God-fearing, for he is Fudail ibn Iyad. And as for the one who is the most knowledgeable of people, and he is Sufyan al-Thawri, who I just mentioned to you earlier. And as for the one who is the most knowledgeable of people in fiqh, he is Abu Hanifa. And he said, Ma ra'aytu fil fiqh mithla. I did not see anybody in fiqh like him. Okay, and also he's got another statement. He said that Ma ra'aytu ahadan qat takallama fil fiqh ahsana min Abi Hanifa. That I have not seen anybody speak about fiqh the way Abu Hanifa spoke about fiqh. And Abdullah bin Mubarak, he's called the Imam of Hadith in his time. He's clearly one of the, you know, the great references for the Muslims. And the last thing I would say to again indicate what the scholars thought about Abu Hanifa, therefore what we need to think about Abu Hanifa, is a statement of someone called Abdullah bin Dawood, or another scholar. He said, يَجِبُ عَلَىٰ أَحْلِ الْإِسْلَامِ أَنْ يَدْعُوَ اللَّهِ لِأَبِي حَنِيفَ فِي الْإِصَّلَاتِهِمْ فَقَدْ حَفِظَ عَلَيْهِمْ السُّنُنْ وَالْفِقْهِ. Which means that it is obligatory upon the people of Islam, i.e. the Muslims, that they make dua for Abu Hanifa in their prayer, because verily he safeguarded the sunan, the sunnah, and fiqh. So that's why people should make dua for him. So that's just a brief introduction upon Abu Hanifa. As for his early years, he lived in a time where the Muslims were being oppressed. Islamic history, basically, if you read about it, you'll see that basically times become after Ali radiallahu anhu, and in fact even at his time and beyond that, which is the first 30-40 years of Islam, after Prophet ﷺ passed away of Hijri, you know, the Muslims, as Prophet ﷺ, he said, the Muslim rulers, they'll be replaced by kingship. Okay? And kingship means basically that, you know, the one who is Khalifa, the one who is ruler amongst the Muslims, it's not the one who is most deserving to have it, but rather it's someone who's related to him. And even if the guy who's related to him is not the most deserving or the most knowledgeable or the most pious or the one who's most just, you know, he'll get it. And because of that, if the people at the top are bad, everything else goes bad, and like that, that's what happens in the Muslim state. It started to go down in its culture, in its justice. So he lived in that type of time. And amongst the people that were very close to when he lived was someone called Hajjaj bin Yusuf. And I'm just trying to give you an example of how bad things go. Hajjaj bin Yusuf, he was the governor of Iraq for roughly 20 years. You know, he killed people from the Sahabi. You know, can you imagine somebody killing somebody from the Sahaba? You know, he killed Abdullah bin Zubair. He killed one of the greatest scholars that ever lived, Sa'id bin Jubair. You know, he was responsible for the killing of Abdullah bin Umar. You know, because Abdullah bin Umar, he was a person that, you know, he was a person that would say the truth no matter who it was. So he said to Hajjaj that, verily, you are a wrongdoer, you are a fasiq. Okay, so what Hajjaj did was that while he was doing Umrah, he took a spear, he paid someone, and while he was doing Umrah, he got someone to spear Abdullah bin Umar through his leg, and this is what led to his death. So basically, you know, he was a very tyrannical rulership. And because of that, knowledge itself went down quite a lot. And in this atmosphere, when Abu Hanifa, he grew up himself, because since his father passed away at a very early age, he didn't have the culture where he was to learn knowledge. And if you look at him and compare him to the other great scholars, like, for example, you know, if you compare him to like Ibn Taymiyyah, Imam Malik, Imam Shafi'i, who from a very early age, you know, their parents were at them saying, look, this is what you need to do, this is the guidance, this is what you need to do, you need to learn this, you need to learn that, you need to go to this scholar, you need to learn other before you learn ilm. He didn't have any of this. Okay? So all he had was his basic Islamic education, which is quite a lot, because Kufa was one of the main fountainheads of Islam. But basically, after his father passed away when he was very early, he began to devote himself to business. Okay? And he took over his father's business, which is the business of clothes. And I will now narrate to you what was the thing that was inspired him to gain knowledge. And this is roughly when he was about 20. Okay? When he was about 20, a scholar named Imam Ash-Sha'bi, okay? And Sha'bi, he is also one of the renowned scholars of Islam. And just to give you Imam Sha'bi's status, that one of the other scholars, whose name is Muhammad bin Sirin, he says that when I came to Kufa, okay, Imam Sha'bi was giving circles, and at that time there were many amongst the Sahaba who were still alive. Do you understand? So there were many people who had seen Prophet themselves alive, and this man, he's giving circles that a lot of people are coming to. So he became a fountainhead of knowledge, even when there were a lot of Sahabi around. And he says, Abu Hanifa, he says, that once I was passing by a place, and Imam Sha'bi, he stopped him, and he said that, you know, where are you going? Where are you going? And Imam Abu Hanifa at this time, who was a young 20-year-old man, you know, a businessman, he said that, you know, I'm going to the marketplace to do my business. And then Imam Sha'bi, he said, no, I don't mean that. I mean, which scholar do you attend? Which scholar do you go? And then he said to him, why? And then he said to him, فَإِنِّي أَرَى فِيكَ يَقْذَةً وَحَرَكَ. Because I see in you that you have a keen, attentive mind, and you are someone who is active. So this is what Imam Sha'bi, he saw this just by looking at him. And he said about the scholars, about the pious scholars, right, the early scholars especially, that they would see with the light of Allah. You know, it wasn't that they would see, you know, they would look at a person and they would see that this guy is someone who did sins a lot. They look at this guy and they would see the nur in his face, that this is someone who worships Allah a lot. And something like that, right, he saw in Abu Hanifa at this very young age that this man, he had something. And Abu Hanifa said, no, I don't go to see any scholar, you know, I'm not a student of anybody, you know, or I'm just going to the market because I'm a businessman. Okay? And then Imam Sha'bi basically just said what I just told you, and then they depart, and then they split company. And Abu Hanifa, he says about this incident that inspired him to start gaining knowledge, he says that, فَوَقْعَ فِي قَلْبِي مِنْ قَوْلِهِ وَتَرَبْتُ لِإِخْتِلَافِ الْأَصْوَاقِ وَأَخَذْتُ فِي الْعِلْمِ فَنَفَعَنِي اللَّهُ بِهِ. Which means that after he said the statement that, you know, I see in you a keen attentive mind, and I see that you're an active person, he said that is if something, you know, affected my heart. Okay, something from his saying, it affected my heart. So I stopped frequent visiting the marketplaces, and I started to devote myself to knowledge. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he benefited me by this man, Imam Sha'bi. And just something else I missed that's important as well. Obviously he was called Abu Hanifa, and that's what he's famous by. But usually when you say Abu Hanifa, you're saying father of Hanifa. Okay, but he had no charge for Hanifa. It was just a kunya that he had. And it's taken from the verse in the Quran, what tabi' millata Ibrahim Hanifa, that follow the way of Ibrahim, who followed it upon a righteous manner. And a few other statements about his family before we carry on, about his early life, that are important, is that he was obviously Persian. He was not from the Arab. And this is also very significant because a lot of the great scholars, in fact the majority of the scholars at that time, they were not Arab. Okay, they were mostly freed slaves or from people entering the deen. They weren't Arabs as such. Okay, and his family was never a slave, and there's a long statement by his son Ismail saying this, but inshallah I won't go through this now. And his father Thabit was a righteous man, and his father, Abu Hanifa's grandfather, was someone who had good relations with Ali radiallahu anhu. And it is said that his father, Thabit, he once went to Ali radiallahu anhu and said to him, look, pray for me and for my family. And Ali radiallahu anhu prayed for him and his family. And it is said that it's from this prayer, that Ali radiallahu anhu did, that they had someone like Abu Hanifa, who the scholars have described, you know, Imam Dhahabi described him as clearly one of the most intelligent people of the son of Adam. After the incident with Imam Sha'bi, Abu Hanifa, at that time, he initially thought to devote himself to fiqh, but for some reason that's not quite clear, he began to specialize in Ahlul Kalam. And people of Kalam were generally those people, you know, who were good at debating, okay? Because their debates were basically how to defend the religion, how to defend Islam. Because in those times, many sects began to arise, okay? Many types of weird ideas began to arise. So what these people used to do, they used to specialize in how to defend the Muslims, how to defend, you know, people from these type of thoughts, okay? And he says that, you know, he started to do this, he became so proficient in this that whenever there was any type of problem like this, whenever there was any type of funny idea, he would go and debate with the guy until such that people began to fear him in his debate. He was very intelligent in the way he used to debate. And he said that most of the people of Kalam were in Basra, and he said that I went to Basra more than 20 times, okay? And sometimes I would stay there a year, sometimes I would stay more than that, just so I could debate with these people. And it was as if that whoever he debated with, he would win. But eventually he saw that the people of Kalam, they had certain problems, okay? The first thing he saw was that the Sahaba, you know, this was not their way, okay? The way of the Sahaba was that they would devote themselves to the practicalities of Islam, i.e. fiqh. Okay, people would come for them for fatwas, and they would give fatwas. It wasn't this thing about debating. Okay, this is the first thing that made him leave the debating. Okay, second thing he realized was that people of debate generally, right? They had hard hearts. They had bad character. They had rough tongues. And the problem with debating is that if you debate a lot, right, and if you see this character generally, people who debate a lot, right, it eventually starts affecting their heart. Okay, because you want to win. Okay, you know, debate somebody, you know, win, and it starts getting personal. Okay, and these people, you know, he saw that these people, a lot of them had this type of characteristics. While the people of fiqh, for example, they had, you know, they were different. Their character was better. They had, you know, they weren't known to abuse. They were people who were devoted to worship, and which is close to the actions of the Sahaba. And the third thing that was the tip of the iceberg, as they say, was that once a woman came to him and said to him that, you know, asked him a certain matter about divorce, and you know, he didn't try to bluff, he didn't try to fob her off, but he asked her something about divorce and he didn't know. And in his vicinity there was a person called Hamad, who was a known faqih, recognized faqih, scholar of fiqh. So he said to her, look, go to Hamad, ask him the question, and whatever he tells you the answer, tell me as well, so that I may learn from this as well. Okay, so he didn't doubt that Hamad knew the answer, but he knew that he didn't know the answer. So she went to Hamad, asked him the question, and Hamad gave the answer and came back to gave her the answer, and she came back to him and told him. And then he thought that this is what I'm going to do now. I'm gonna leave Ahlul Kalam, I'm gonna leave this debating, and I'm gonna devote myself to fiqh. So now that Abu Hanifa, now that he's entered learning knowledge properly, I just want to mention some of his teachers, because if you look at any great person, you'll see that he's, you know, he'll be inspired by great people who are around him. Maybe these great people won't be mentioned so much. Maybe, you know, it's a great characteristic in one person, and one and then another, then another, then another, and all of them come together in this one person. But you know, it's without doubt that you are like your company. And Prophet ﷺ said so as well, obviously in a hadith, that you are like the company that you hang around with, and you'll be raised up with the company that you hang around with. It is said that his teachers, you know, they're a humongous number. Okay, some say 4,000, some say, you know, less than that. But his teachers, they were a humongous number. Okay, but so inshallah we'll concentrate upon a few of them, and we'll talk about some of the characteristics. So inshallah we can see, so we can learn something from that as well. And just before I carry on, later on in his life, his foremost and most important teacher was someone called Hamad. Okay, Hamad, he was a recognized faqih in Kufa, as I've already described to you. And Hamad ibn Sulaiman, who died 120 Hijri, he was the main student of Ibrahim al-Nakhai, who gained knowledge from a number of Sahaba, but amongst them the most prominent one amongst them was Abdullah bin Mas'ud. Ibrahim al-Nakhai. And Abu Hanifa, he says that, you know, in total he spent with Hamad 18 years. Okay? But he says about his time with him, he says that basically that initially when I joined him, you know, I sat with the newcomers. Okay? But after a little while, Hamad saw that this man, he was gifted. And as all teachers, when they see somebody who's gifted or who spends a lot of energy, you know, they make him come forward. Okay? And he made him sit with the most recognized people. Eventually, Hamad made him sit right in front of him. Okay? And it became known that, you know, Abu Hanifa was one of his foremost students. And after 10 years, you know, after 10 years, right, Abu Hanifa, and 10 years is a long time, you know, that's basically two medical degrees, you know, two MBBSs for those of you who study medicine. Abu Hanifa thought that, you know, now I've gained enough knowledge, you know, now it's time for me to start my own circles. Okay, so. So on that day he comes into the main mosque of Kufa, and there he sees a teacher, Hamad. And he says that when he saw Hamad giving this lecture, he said that, you know, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't start my own lecture. No, you know, not now. Not the way he saw. It was something I respect for Hamad, he couldn't do it. So he sat down and he began to, you know, listen to Hamad like he always did. And on that very day, he says that one of Hamad's relatives passed away in Basra. Okay? So and Hamad was therefore he had to go to Basra, you know, to deal with this matter of the inheritance, because he was the only one who could deal with it. So Hamad, before he left, he says to Abu Hanifa that, you know, you take my place as teacher, and you teach, you take my place. So you see, subhanAllah, how Allah subhanAllah, he blessed Abu Hanifa in that something that he wanted to do, he made him do it in a way that was much better than that. And that was to start his own class, but with the permission of Hamad, and also with the supervision of Hamad. Okay, so Hamad, he then goes for roughly 2 months, and people ask him questions. Okay, and whatever question he knew that Hamad, they heard, where he heard from Hamad, he gave the same answer. But he says that people came with him with 60 new questions, and of those 60 questions, and all those 60 questions, he wrote down the question, he wrote down the answer. So that when Hamad came back, you know, he told them about every single one of those 60 questions. And he says that Hamad, he agreed with me with 40, and he disagreed with me in 20. And then he said, then Abu Hanifa said that by that I knew that there was still a lot of knowledge in Hamad that I didn't have. You know, and also he says that, it says sometimes I would go to Basra, right, you know, thinking that, you know, I know a lot of stuff, I know a lot of knowledge. Okay, because Hamad was pretty much the main authority in Kufa at the time. And people would be asking questions that, you know, he just didn't know. And we'd go back to Hammad, and Hammad would know the answer to these questions. So he knew that Hammad, he still had a lot of knowledge to give. And he remained a student for a further 8 years. In fact, he says that when he came back after this Basra event, he said to himself that, "I'll remain Hammad's student until he passes away. I'll remain a student. I don't care. You know, he has more knowledge than me. You know, he's clearly the one who's more superior than me, and I will remain a student." And he remained his student until Hammad passed away, which is 8 years after that. Which is 120 after Hijri, and therefore he's a student totally for 18 years. So what we can learn from this, the main thing we can learn from this is that, you know, to gain the knowledge that Abu Hanifa gained, he wasn't just sitting around, okay? You know, he was his main student, you know, he was recognized as his main student after 10 years, and for a further 8 years he devoted himself for it. So this knowledge, you know, this deen, this inheritance from the Prophet is only gained by striving. And Abu Hanifa would say afterwards, he would say afterwards about Hammad when he passed away, and this is something that he would obviously say to teach his students, okay? He would say, "Wallahi, ma da'awtu li waliday bil maghfira illa da'awtu li Hammad. Wa ma dhakartu waliday illa dhakartu Hammada." Which means that, "I swear to you by Allah that I never made dua for my parents for forgiveness, except I made dua for Hammad, and I never remembered my parents, except I remembered Hammad." This was the amount of respect his teacher Hammad he had in the heart of Abu Hanifa, and this also shows you the respect that, you know, we need to give our teachers as well, whoever they are, that they deserve respect because they are more, they have gained, you know, this inheritance of the prophets. And especially the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And just to talk about his teacher Ibrahim al-Nakhai, you know, he's also, you know, like I said, he's also one of the recognized scholars, you know, one of the biggest tabi'in, one of the biggest, because Abu Hanifa, since he is a tabi'in, but he's one of the late tabi'in by far, okay? Because he was born 80 after Hijri, he just met Anas bin Malik, and that was it, okay? So he's not like the other tabi'een, the early tabi'een who met Sahaba, spent a long time with them, like Imam Hassan al-Basri, Atta bin Abi Rabah, who spent a long time with the Sahaba. Okay, so he's one of the late tabi'een. While Ibrahim al-Nakhai, he was one of the, you know, he's one of the established tabi'een. And he also, when he saw some of the rulers making doing unjust acts, and during the early years, people like to think that they were, you know, all the scholars, right, didn't do any rebellions, but this is not true. Okay, Ibrahim al-Nakhai, he's one of the people who revolted against the Khalif of his time. Okay, and, you know, and Sa'id bin Jubair, he said when the people of Kufa used to come to him asking fatwas, he would say to them that, "You asked me to give you fatwas, and you have with you Ibrahim al-Nakhai." So you know, he was saying basically that, you know, basically he's trying to say that, you know, you come to me, you know, and Sa'id bin Jubair is a recognized scholar, that you come to me to ask to get fatwas, right? Well, you have this man Ibrahim, who is a, you know, he's also a recognized scholar, and he was somebody who was who used to speak for the truth, and once when he saw one of the emirs walking, you know, very proudly, you know, he said to him right to his face that, you know, "This is not the way. This is not the way that the Muslims walk," you know, right to his face. And it is said that the fiqh of Abu Hanifa actually comes from Ibrahim al-Nakhai, because Ibrahim al-Nakhai, he's the one who gained knowledge from the Sahaba, so the roots come to Ibrahim al-Nakhai, and from him Hammad learned his knowledge, and from him Abu Hanifa. Okay, so there's pretty much a direct chain. And Ibrahim al-Nakhai learned his knowledge from a number of scholars, and in fact, once towards the end of Abu Hanifa's time, he entered upon the court of Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, one of the Abbasi Khalifas, and he says to Abu Hanifa, "Ya Abu Hanifa," because, like I said, there were many people who had hasad, who were envious of Abu Hanifa, saying, you know, had many different things about him that were bad about him. He says to him, "Ya Abu Hanifa, an man akhadt al-ilm?" "O Abu Hanifa, from whom did you take knowledge?" And Abu Hanifa, he said, "Qultu faqultu," I said, "an Hamad, an Ibrahim, an Umar bin al-Khattab, an Abi Ali bin Abi Talib, an Abdullah bin Mas'ud, wa Abdullah bin Abdullah bin Abbas," which means that when the Khalifa said to him that, "From whom do you take knowledge?" Abu Hanifa, he said that, "I took knowledge from Hamad, who took it from Ibrahim, who took it from Umar bin al-Khattab, who took it from Ali bin Abi Talib, who took it from Ali bin Abi Talib, and Abdullah bin Mas'ud, and Abdullah bin Abbas." Okay? And then Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, he said, you know, Bakhin, which means, you know, excellent, you know, that's enough, I'm happy now. You know, your credentials, you know, you can't have better than that, basically. So this is something about this is just to give you something about something about his main teacher. Also, as inshallah you'll see later on, right, that Abu Hanifa he's very generous to his students. And once one of his students, Abu Yusuf, says to him that, you know, that something like, you know, "Wallahi, I have not seen anyone more generous than you." Okay, because Abu Hanifa, he basically funded Abu Yusuf, his student, for roughly 20 years. For him and his family, for roughly 20 years, he funded him. Okay, you know, gave him money for his living and expenses, whatever. And Abu Hanifa, he replied to that by saying that, "How would it have been if you had seen Hamad? How would it have been if you had seen Hamad? I, you know, this generosity that you see me doing, you know, I learned this from Hamad. You know, this adab, I learned this from Hamad." So it's not just knowledge he gained, it's not just knowledge you gain, rather you gain adab, you gain manners, you gain other things. And this is what really makes a person. It's not the knowledge, it's other things with the knowledge that forces him towards something. As for Imam al-Sha'bi, who I've just talked about earlier, who's the main guy, who's the main scholar who inspired him, he died 103 after Hijri. Okay, when Abu Hanifa was roughly 23, so he didn't gain that much knowledge from him, but whatever little he gained from him, you know, was obviously significant, because he was the main person who inspired him to start gaining knowledge. And like I said to you earlier, Muhammad bin Sirin said that Imam Sha'bi, he was a recognized scholar during the lifetimes of the Sahaba. He was that intelligent, he was that smart. And also, you know, obviously he gained, you know, obviously he gained a lot of adab from him as well. And one of the statements of Imam Sha'bi, one of the things he was renowned for was his patience, especially if people were rude to him, patience in gaining knowledge as well. But there's a very famous statement that comes from him that somebody once abused him. Okay, somebody once abused him, and he replied back to him and he said to him that, "In kunta sadiqan, ghafar Allahu li." That when this man abused him, right, said something really bad about him, he said to him that, if you are truthful about what you are saying, then may Allah forgive me. "Wa in kunta kadiban," and if you are a liar about what you are saying, "ghafar Allahu lak," that may Allah forgive you. And then he walked away. That was the end of the matter. That if you are truthful, then may Allah forgive me, and if you are lying, then may Allah forgive you. He didn't reply back to him. He didn't start cursing him back. He said, called it that, and that was it. And that would, you know, and that would have more effect of a person than if you start abusing him back. But that's the way of the scholars. They didn't get involved in these type of things. Another of the scholars that he gained knowledge from was Atta ibn Abi Rabah. Okay, who is, if I'm not mistaken, who's the freed slave of Abdullah bin Umar. Okay, he grew up in Makkah, he lived in Makkah, even though he's from the people of Yemen, and he was, you know, Habashi. Okay, he was black. Okay, he obviously gained knowledge from some of the main scholars, Okay, he was such a recognized scholar that during the time of Hajj, announcement would be made in Mecca that no one should give fatwa except Atha bin Abi Rabah, and then his student. Okay, and he also was of the scholars that rebelled against the rulers of his time, so much so that he had his hand cut off during one of the wars. Atha bin Abi Rabah had his hands cut off when he revolted against, I think it was Hajjaj, if I'm not mistaken. But he revolted against one of the Khulafa of his time, and he had his hand cut off. And Abu Hanifa, he gained a lot of knowledge from him, because Abu Hanifa, he would travel a lot. Okay, he would travel to different cities a lot. And it said that Abu Hanifa, concerning Makkah, he made Hajj roughly 55 times. Okay, so basically, you know, he died at the age of 70, so that's you can work that from yourself, the calculations from that. But he says about Atha bin Abi Rabah, he says about Atha bin Abi Rabah that verily I did not see anybody more better. I didn't see anybody better than Atha. I didn't see anybody better, you know, in any way than Atha bin Abi Rabah. Some of his other scholars that I would like to talk about, but there's no time, was Nafi'i, a recognized scholar, Imam Baqir, who was one of the sons of, who's the son of Zain al-Abidin, who's the son of Hussein, who's the son of Ali bin Abi Talib, i.e. one of the descendants of Ali radiallahu anhu, who is also a recognized scholar. He also was a student of Ja'far al-Sadiq, was also one of the recognized scholars, and other scholars as well, whom basically I don't have time to speak about right now. Going further, talking about his knowledge, his wisdom. like I said to you earlier, there's a lot of controversy about his knowledge, okay? But hopefully, inshallah, I've cleared this by telling you statements from people who actually knew him. Okay? And also, the effect of his knowledge, this is apparent. If you go to the Muslim world today, you'll see the Hanafi fiqh, how it's spread. You see that, if you study fiqh anywhere, you see, the you know, when you study contemporary fiqh al-Muqarin, fiqh of all schools, they obviously study the fiqh of Abu Hanifa or the fiqh of his school. Okay? And Imam Shafi, he would say that people are all children of Abu Hanifa in fiqh. And the thing about Abu Hanifa in specific was he was one of the first people to start classifying fiqh into areas. Like he would say, this is the fiqh of salah, so put into this section. This is the fiqh of zakah, put into this section. He's the first from amongst the ulama to start doing this. Okay, and that's why when you heard the statement of that earlier scholar saying that it's a ability upon all people of the earth to make dua for him, because he's the first man to have such a great deep knowledge of fiqh, to start thinking this way, to start classifying it, so therefore making the matter easy upon the people. And he was very careful about giving fatwas. And in fact, when somebody said to him that, what, you know, that you should fear Allah in giving fatwas, he said that if it wasn't for the fact that Allah would ask me about my knowledge, I would not give fatwas. You know, it's because of the fact that Allah is going to ask me about this knowledge, this is why I give fatwas. And he was also very, he was in his wisdom, he was in his hikmah, he was in his, in, you know, result of the fiqh he gained, right, of life and of the deen, that he would stay away from the government, and he wouldn't take any governmental positions. And I've already mentioned to you, right, you know, how oppressive they were. But at the same time, there were also many scholars who did take governmental positions, and this is two different schools of thought, and it's not our place to go into it right now today. just to mention his physical appearance, he was of medium height, he was of handsome features, he was not very short, he was well spoken, he's very articulate. Okay, when he spoke of a problem, they say that he could make the most simple, the most hardest of problems simple for the people, and he would always speak to the level of the people, and this is how we'd solve their problems. Okay, his way of dress was that he would wear the best of clothes. You know, some people, you know, they wear, you know, they wear tattered clothes. You know, they wear clothes that aren't that so good, but he would always wear the best of clothes, and he was recognized for this, and even when he would go to salah, he'd wear the best of clothes. In fact, people would say to him that, you know, the clothes that you wear for salah, you know, people wear these type of clothes when they go see the rulers or when they go to weddings. And he would say to them that verily, you know, Allah has more right that you should make yourself beautiful for him than the people do. Do you understand? That Allah has more right that you make yourself beautiful for him, i.e. we should make ourselves more beautiful for Allah than, you know, when you go to a wedding. You know, we should make ourselves more beautiful for prayer when you go to the mosque than we go for the wedding. This is something that he used to do. And they used to say about him that you could smell him from his ether. That you'd always perfume himself and look nice. And he would wear a nice turban, he would wear nice thobes. And like I said to you earlier, as I talk about his livelihood, right? His business was clothes. So he knew the clothes. And he also loved to joke as well. Okay? Once, and I'll just give you one of the jokes that he made. Okay, once in his own area there was a Shia who was a fanatical Shia, and we know the Shia, you know, they love Imam Ali and they dislike Abu Bakr and they dislike Umar, they dislike Aisha and so on and so forth. And to dislike these people is in fact, you know, to go against Islam itself. As a lot of scholars have said that if you hate these people, then really you've gone out of the religion. But this man, right, he had two donkeys, and he named the donkeys Abu Bakr wa Umar. You know, insulting these companions, radiallahu anhum. And one day it happened that one of the donkeys of this miller, this Shia, he kicked him in the head so hard that he died. Okay? And when Abu Hanifa, he heard this, right, he said that it must be the donkey that was named Umar. and it so happened that he was true. It was a donkey named Umar that kicked the Shia in the head and killed him. But it's just, and there are other jokes that he made as well, and they're all true jokes or something like this, or this nature. He didn't make jokes to lie. To talk about his livelihood, apart from the fact of him gaining knowledge, he was a successful merchant. Okay, and it is said that his store of clothes in Kufa was one of the biggest of stores. You know, something like, you know, the Harrods of Kufa. You know, people from all around the city would come to it, okay? Because they knew they would find good quality, you know, truthfulness. And also Abu Hanifa, you know, he would travel to other cities as well, you know, to Basra, other places as well for his business. And he had a partner with which, because you know, you can't run a business and obviously, you know, gain knowledge the way he gained knowledge. So he had a partner who would do a lot of the things he told him to do, and he had other employees as well, including his son Hamad, and other employees as well. And one of the things he would warn them about is female customers, because obviously with clothes, especially he would deal with silk, with clothes that were silk, clothes made out of silk. He'd warn his people about silk, and he would say to them that one of the things he warned them about is that anybody. And obviously the people, the women then, they don't dress like the women that we see in this country, obviously. One of the things he would warn his employees about was that he would say to them that if you can describe the shoes of the woman, then you can describe the feet of the woman. And if you can describe the feet of the woman, then basically you are being unjust. You are not a just person. And he was very adamant about this. So he said, he always told them to, you know, lower their gaze. But, you know, he was so adamant about this. He said that even when you lower your gaze, try not to look at their shoes, try not to look at their feet, try not to look at their, you know, if they're wearing slippers, their skin, that part. So he was very smart about how people should deal with them. And he had a very precise system, but which I don't have time to go into at the moment. And his daily routine about gaining knowledge was that, you know, in the morning after Fajr, he would spend 2-3 hours with, you know, in his business, finding what's going on, make sure everything's going okay, give his orders, whatever. Then after that, pretty much he would spend the rest of the day gaining knowledge. And he would spend... I think he would spend Friday he would spend entertaining guests in particular, and Saturday he would spend especially for his family and his own personal needs. And he was very truthful in his livelihood. You know, once he told his partner that, you know, go sell these clothes, but these clothes are defective. So if you sell these clothes, make sure you tell the people that these clothes are defective. I don't want you to sell these clothes, you know, without telling people they're defective. And his partner, who's also a truthful person, because, you know, Abu Hanifa, he wouldn't deal with, you know, obviously his partner wouldn't be a liar or a corrupt person. He sold his clothes and he forgot. And once he realized that he had forgot to tell the people, he tried to find them. Okay, but he couldn't find them. When Abu Hanifa, he heard about this, he was so upset that all the profit he made from those transactions, he gave away in charity. You know, he wanted to keep his rizq totally, you know, clean, untouched, halal. And obviously this is one of the blessings that that eventually came upon him later on. Okay? And he would, other things, that other principles that he had, that, you know, the people that you sit with him in his knowledge, people that you knew personally, he would not try to gain any profit from them. He would try to sell things to them at cost value. And if somebody was very poor, again, he would be very lenient towards them. You know, he would sell things at cost value, or he would bring the price down. And there are many examples towards this, but since time is short, inshallah, I just want to tell you the principles about it now. And the profit, and the profits that he would gain from all the successful business that he would have, he would spend upon his students, upon the fuqaha, muhaddithin, you know, and upon other people who needed the money. Okay, he would spend upon them, and this is actually a very important principle. And when he would give them the money, give them their daily allowances, he would say to them that this is the profit of your own attributes, of the merchandise, of your attributes, of your characteristics that Allah has given to you via me. Okay, so don't thank me for it. This is what Allah has given to you via me. Nothing to do with me. It's not my money. Okay, and there's no risk. No one has any power, any risk, but Allah, you know, Allah is the one, he has power over the risk. And this is actually something that universities, you know, obviously we know that universities, they give grants out, but this is something that he thought about doing way before other people did this. Okay, I mean, obviously there were other scholars that he learned this from, but you know, this is type of the principles that he gained. And you can only do this right if you have money. If you saw yourself in the financial side. Abu Hanifa, he fed me in the dunya and he fed me in the akhirah. You know, he fed me in the dunya when he gave me money, and it's later on when he became judge of judges, it's because of the fact that, you know, he became such a great judge, because he was a student of, he was such an important student of Abu Hanifa, that he became the judge of judges in the time of Harun al-Rashid, you know, that he gained livelihood then as well. And also he fed him the Akhirah, because it's the knowledge that he gained from that which inspired him to be so pious, obviously. So, and also, like I said to you earlier, that he implemented this principle that the best risk that you can have, the best food that you eat from, is the food that you've earned yourself. You know, he didn't believe in handouts. Okay, because, you know, one of the things he realized was that everything has strings attached. And if you look at the ulama later on, even if you look at the ulama his time, right, you'll see this clearly, how, you know, the strings are always attached to everything. And about his piety, his devotedness, Imam Zahabi says that about his piety, that, you know, it's reached us through a tawatur chain. I mean, basically, there are so many chains about his piety that, you know, it's without doubt, you know, no one can argue this point. He's a very pious person. Okay? And I've already told about his daily routine, about gaining knowledge. Okay? And a lot of people have said about him that that when he was someone who didn't speak a lot, but when he did speak, okay, when he did speak, he was like a fountain flowing. That's obviously related to fiqh. Al-Fudayl ibn Iyad, he says about Abu Hanifa, he says, Kana Abu Hanifa. Abu Hanifa was, I won't say the Arabic because time is short, I'll just say the English. And if everyone wants the Arabic, can get it from me later on. He said that Abu Hanifa, he was a man who was a faqih, and he was well known for his fiqh, well known for his piety, one who was very rich, and who was known for his generosity upon those who were around him, and he was one who had great sabr upon teaching knowledge in the evenings, in the nights, and in the mornings, and he was one who spent his nights very usefully, i.e. spent them in tahajjud, and he was one who was who was given to having long silences, literal speech, until if somebody said to him a matter, i.e. asked him about a fatwa, about halal or haram, then he would be very good upon speaking about the truth. And he was somebody who was always fleeing from the wealth of the sultan, and if a matter came upon him upon which there was hadith that was sahih, he would follow it, and if something came from the sahaba or the tabi'een, he would take it, And if then he didn't find something, if he still didn't find something from after that, then he would do qas, then he would do qiyas, which is analogy. So this is how Fudayl ibn Iyad describing. And I've already told you what Abdullah ibn Mubarak said, and Yahya bin Harun, he says something similar as well, something like this, talking about his piety. But just to give you a few specific examples about his piety, one of the people of his time says that once I prayed Isha with him, okay, in this is in Kufa, and the people left and I remained, because you know what I wanted to do was I wanted to ask him something private. You know, I wanted to ask him a fit question that's private, just between me and him. Okay, so, you know, I was behind him, because he was in front of me, and I sat behind him waiting for him to finish whatever he was doing. And then he got up and started to pray. Okay, and then he started to pray, right, and he started to recite sunnah, right, and he was writing loudly so that this man could hear him. And when he reached the verse, the transition which is, so Allah has been gracious to us, and he has saved us from the torment of the fire. You know, he began to repeat it again and again and again, that Allah has been gracious to us and he has saved us from the torment of the fire. And he just kept repeating it and repeating it. And this man, he didn't know what to do. So he just waited and he waited and he waited and waited. And you know what happened eventually? Upon this very same verse, the Adhan of Fajr came. So Abu Hanifa spent the whole night, you know, unable to go past this verse because it affected him so much. And this man, he says that, you know, when he sat there, right, he didn't know that it seemed as if Abu Hanifa thought that everybody had left the mosque. Yazid bin Khumayt, another person, he relates that once the Mu'addin, he recited Suratul Zilzalah. Okay, and does everyone know Idha Zulzilatil Ardhu Zilzalaha? Does everyone know that surah? Okay, it's a surah from where Allah says, It's one of the surahs in the 30th juz, and it begins with إِذَا زُلْزِلْتِ الْأَرْضُ زِلْزَالَهَا. You'll see, if you go through it, you'll find it, inshallah. Okay, but it basically talks about when the earth is shaken. It talks about the fact that when the people will be gathered on the day of judgment. It talks about the fact that on that day, you know, everyone who's done even an atom's weight of good will see it that day, and anyone who's done an atom's weight of evil will see it that day. And he says basically that when the Mu'addin Ali bin Hussein, who's known to be a pious man, when he recited the surah, he recited it, he did the salah, he said salam, people started to leave. He said that, you know, I was sitting, you know, this man Yazid, he said I was one of the people who used to look after the mosque. Okay, and one of his jobs was to, you know, take the lantern, the lamps, to the lamps itself, turn the lamps off. He said, so I was waiting for Abu Hanifa to leave. And I saw that Abu Hanifa, he was sitting there, right, just, you know, like as if he was contemplating, taking very deep breaths, so he said, right, that he saw him just doing this again and again and again. So after a little while, he thought that basically Abu Hanifa is not going to get up. So he thought, okay, I'll leave the lamp the way it is, and I'll come back in the morning, and he left. And then in the morning he came back, because this guy, he used to do the Adhan for Fajr. And he saw Abu Hanifa in the same place, just sitting there, looking very sad, holding his beard, saying, I'll say to you in Arabic what he said. You know, he heard him saying, right, he said, Ya man yadzi bi mithqali dharratin khayrin khayra, wa ya man yadzi bi mithqali dharrati sharrin sharra, أجري عبدك نعمان من النار وباعد بينه وبين ما يقربه ويقربه منها وأدخله في واسع رحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين. So he says that after Fajr I came back, and all I hear him saying is this same statement again and again. He's saying, oh, the one who rewards the weight of an atom weight of good, oh, the one who rewards the weight of an atom weight of evil with evil, save your servant Nu'man from the fire and distance him from it and from whatever makes him come close to it, and make him enter the vastness of your mercy, O the one who is the most merciful, Arham al-Rahimin. So basically he spent the whole night saying this. So Yazid, he still didn't want to disturb Abu Hanifa, so he did the adhan. And after the adhan, he went to turn the candle off, because obviously now it's Fajr now. And Abu Hanifa, when he sees him trying to take the candle away, you know, he says that, you know, why are you taking the candle away? And Yazid, he says to him that, you know, I've just done the adhan for Fajr. And Abu Hanifa then looks shocked. Okay, and then he says to him that, you know, don't tell anybody what you've seen tonight. And he sat there until he prayed Fajr. He prayed Fajr with the wudu of Isha. So that's just another example telling you about, you know, how the Quran will affect him and about his piety. Allah said to you, right, it's a unanimous chain. And also I've told you about the fact that he would wear the best of clothes towards Salah. I'm flicking through the pages because my time's running out. And he was very keen to help the people. Whenever they had any problems, he would help the people. When people had problems of debt, he was known to, you know, give somebody some money and say, look, right, just take it, pay the debt, you know, be free. Okay? And, you know, there's many different stories about him and his neighbors. Okay? The way, you know, his reaction with people abused him, he never replied back to him. Okay? Once someone called him the son of a zinner, okay, Ibn Zani. Okay, he didn't say anything to him, he just let him say what he wants, that's it. And it's well known the fact that you know, that like I said to you, people were very envious of him. Okay? And once Abdullah bin Mubarak, he says to Sufyan al-Thawri that, you know, I've seen so many people envious of Abu Hanifa. I've never heard him say anything bad about his enemies. Okay? And when you say something bad about, you know, another Muslim and he's not there, that's a ghibah. Okay, and basically, you know, what the end result of that is basically you are giving him your good deeds. And Sufyan al-Thawri, he said, that is because Abu Hanifa, he's too intelligent to let anybody take his good deeds. That's why he never did any ghibah. And there's many different debates that he had with different people, and I'll just mention a few of them, unfortunately, because time is very, very short. There was once a man, for example, right, and there were many people who were very... a lot of funny ideas. There was once a man in Kufa who began to say that Uthman ibn Affan was a Yahudi, was a Jewish. Okay? And he began to come with these funny ideas, with funny evidences and everything like this, right, towards this. And he began to spread this knowledge amongst the people. When Abu Hanifa, he heard this, right, he went to this man, and Abu Hanifa is a well-known person. Okay? He went to this man and he said to him, look, I know a man, because I know you have a daughter, who's truthful, knows the Quran by heart, is you know, very pious, very generous, very rich, you know, and you know, basically, is suitable to be married to your daughter. And this man, you know, he said that people like you, Abu Hanifa, you know, they're not refused, especially if someone like you comes and recommends them. Then Abu Hanifa says to him that except one thing, he's got one problem. And the man goes, what? He goes, he's Jewish. And the man, right, he got really angry. And he goes that, you know, you've come to me, right? You know, you come to me saying that you want my daughter to marry this Jewish man. And Abu Hanifa says to him that what you said was worse than that. What you said is worse than that, because you said Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam let two of his daughters marry a Yahudi, a Jewish man. And then the man, you know, he said, Astaghfirullah min tawbah, you know, I won't say this again. Okay, what? So therefore, right, when other people would have come with, you know, historical evidences, right? He came with a way that, you know, that man had nothing to say; he was speechless, and that was the way of Abu Hanifa. When people had problems, you know, he would try to solve them in such a way that there was no dispute amongst them. There are other examples that I would have liked to tell you, but I can't. Okay. I mean, let me just give you one example from each of the different categories. Concerning his family, okay? And as I've told you before, his father passed away very early, and he obviously became a very renowned scholar, and his mother, she lived a long time. And as her mother grew old, and as all parents grow old, you know, it's obligatory upon us to become more and more kind towards them. Because, you know, as Prophet ﷺ, he said that, you know, people, they begin, you know, as babies, as, you know, And they'll end up like people with the mental age of a baby. I.e. they begin to have poor memories, they begin to be very illogical, very irrational. And there's more than once when his mother would have a question, right? She would ask Abu Hanifa. Abu Hanifa would tell the answer, and he would say, "No, I'm not accepting that." And just to give you one example, right, once she said something, right, and Abu Hanifa told her the answer, he said, no, that's not the answer. Sirati said, that's not the answer. Let's go to this man called Zurqa. And Zurqa, right, he was someone who is a very good orator, you know, basically a da'iyah, someone who would give a lot of speeches, give a lot of circles, right, very good at speaking. Okay, and he was renowned for this, but he wasn't a scholar. Okay, so when she came with Abu Hanifa, right, and she asked the question to Zurqa, you know, he was amazed. He goes that, you know, he said to her that, you know, should I give you fatwa and you have the faqih of Kufa, the main scholar of fiqh of Kufa with you? How can I do this? I can't. This man, you know, he's the man you should be asking. But Abu Hanifa took the man to the side and said, look, this is what you do. This, the answer to this question is this, just say it to her. He goes, that's it, I'll say that to her. So he went to the mother and he said to her exactly what Abu Hanifa said to her. And even though Abu Hanifa had already told her this answer, but when it came from this man, Zurqa, Abu Hanifa's mother took it, accepted it, said, oh, that's the answer, as if she never had it before, said, fine. So Abu Hanifa, you know, he bore these things with patience. You know, and this is the way we should be with our parents. And this is the way the ulama were always with their parents. You know, a very, very special relationship. Even though, you know, even if they might do something wrong, right, you have to give them that respect. And he gave this to them. As for his relationship with the scholars, like I said to you before, right, there were many people who were envious of him, and he would never reply back to them. Okay, and it's known, and his students bear witness to this. Okay, that he was a man that, you know, didn't reply back to the things that people said to him. And and I'll give you just one example, right, to show you how Abu Hanifa, right, he was in his fiqh, he was clearly at a level that was above other people. Once what happened was, and how he helped the people, and inshallah I'm coming towards the end soon as well. And once what happened was that there was a man, he had two sons, and so he decided to get them married on the same night. Okay? And what happened was that the two sons, that night there was a mix-up, and the wife of one man went with one man, the other brother, and the wife of that husband went with the other man. So they, you know, they spent the night together, and the morning they realized their mistake. So they went to Abu Hanifa and they went to Imam Sufyan Thawri. They were all in one big gathering. Okay, I'm nearly finishing. This will be the last one. Okay. They went to the gathering of the scholars, right? And they asked Imam Sufyan Thawri first, because he was obviously the most knowledgeable one. And Imam Sufyan Thawri, he said to them that, look, it's not a problem, not a problem. You know, you prayed the mahar, which is fine. You know, just the one who's married with that person goes back to the original husband. Okay, so this woman who spent the night with this man, go back to the other man, because, you know, this is the person you're married with. Okay, and that's the answer to your solution. Then another student, he gets up, right, and he sees Abu Hanifa, he's all quiet, doesn't say anything. He says, Abu Hanifa, you speak. You give your answer to this problem. Okay? Abu Hanifa, he goes to the man, go bring your two sons. So he brought the two sons, then he takes each one of the sons and he speaks to them individually. He says to the son, look, the woman that you spent the night with, i.e. your brother's wife, okay, what do you think about her? He goes, yeah, fine, I don't mind her. He goes, would you mind her being your real wife now? He goes, no, I don't mind. He asked the same question to the other brother. He said the same thing. Okay. He goes, in that case, you say that you divorce the wife you got married to, and you the other brother, say you divorce the wife you got married to, and he said to the father, get married again. And then the student who said to him, Abu Hanifa, speak. He got up and said, you know, he got up and started shouting. Now you see why I love him. Are you reproaching me for me loving him? Now you see why I love him, because what Abu Hanifa had done, he had found the solution that left the least psychological scar upon the people. And this is what Abu Hanifa did. He looked for the solution that left the least scar amongst the people. What was the solution for the people? And this is, while Sufyan Thawri, his answer was correct as well, but Abu Hanifa's answer was more correct. There are other very famous examples about this, but I'll skip that. I'll just mention now how he passed away, and that's it. Okay. Basically, like I said, right, the rulers more than once they tried to bribe him. They said they would give him money, and he would always refuse them. Every single time he would refuse them. Okay, and they would try to order him, and they would order him to come judge from amongst the Khulafa, from the Muslim government, from the Islamic government. Okay, he would always refuse, and twice he was tried for this. Okay, the first time round he swore by Allah that he would never take position for this, and for this he was whipped. He was whipped 10 times every day, right, amongst the people. Abu Hanifa was whipped, and then eventually, right, people, you know, eventually the governor realized that he might kill Abu Hanifa, and therefore that would be, you know, very bad for him. You know, suggesting that, why don't you go discuss with the people? Abu Hanifa said, fine, I'll discuss with the people. So what Abu Hanifa did, right, was that he said, I'll discuss with the people, and immediately what he did was he ran away. He ran away from Kufa, and he fled to Mecca, and he stayed in Mecca for about 8-9 years. He stayed until the government changed from Bani Umayyah to Bani Abbas. And then again, another tyrannical rulership came, and again they tried to make Abu Hanifa judge, but no, they wanted to make him justice minister, the minister of justice, judge of judges. And again he refused, and again, you know, it got to such a state that the Khalifa said, I swear that you will become judge. Abu Hanifa said, I swear that I will not become judge. And he was eventually put into prison. And even before he was put in prison, there was a few revolts against the Khalifa, Abu Ja'far al-Mansur. Abu Hanifa openly supported these revolts, and he regretted that he didn't take part in it physically. And he gave people fatwas to go and fight for this. And in fact, he said to the people, he said to one person who would come back making jihad against the kuffar, he said that it would be better for you to make jihad against the rulers in this against this particular ruler. He said than for you to make jihad against the kuffar. He said this. And eventually, because of this type of thought, Abu Ja'far had him imprisoned and had him poisoned, and he passed away. And when he passed away, more than 50,000 people came to do janazah for him, and the rest, you know, inshallah. The effect and other things, inshallah, we don't have time for. If there are any further questions, anything that's not unclear, please let me, inshallah, be able to do them later on. The main knowledge, the main points, just the main lessons that we can gain from that very, very quickly, it's basically the knowledge that he gained, okay, from his teachers, from his people, from the adab. This is what made him have these type of stances, okay? And also, you know, you also learn how he dealt with the people, how he has attitude towards learning, how the importance of having good company is. These are just some of the lessons we gain, and there are many other lessons as well. SubhanAllah wa bihamdika wa ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta wa astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.